You are listening to WCJV Digital Broadcasting, Youngstown, New York.
ParanewsInsider.com. Produced by WCJV Digital Broadcasting, Youngstown, New York.
Welcome to the Paranormal News Insider for the week of March 20th, 2018, and episode number 354. And this is your very well-balanced host, Dr. Brian D. Parson, doing my egg impression right here. It's equinox. It's the first day of spring. Spring has sprung. Well, for most of us. Well, some of us. I don't know. We still might get some snow. But, yeah, it's the equinox. And I'm also back, in case you... I don't know, you might not have known, but I wasn't here last week. Took a week off, a little under the weather. I don't know why they say that, under the weather. I was sick, more or less, battling the flu, and the flu was winning for quite a few days. And so I'm still fighting a little bit of voice issues, so pardon me in advance if I clear my throat. I usually do that anyway to... get something across, but I might have some little minor issues tonight, but I'm going to work my way through it because we've got a lot of news to cover, and I'm not really going to rehash what happened 2 weeks ago. Honestly, I was really not even paying any attention to anything, to be honest, but I don't think there was a whole lot going on. But this week, we've got a full slate, and we're going to be talking a lot about Bigfoot. It seems like I'm looking at my notes here. Bigfoot in North Carolina. Get your Bigfootology degree. Finding Futon. Bigfoot tossed out of court. A lot of Bigfoot stories tonight. And yes, we're going to tackle that ancient reptile that supposedly washed up on the shore in Georgia. And I'll also talk about science losing its brightest star. And we'll also have the book of the week. It's a big book. I had to have help bringing it into the studio. It's big. It's a big book. It's heavy. But not heavy like that. It's heavy. No, it's heavy. It's big. It's like 300-400 pages. But it's a good book. And before I get too involved, let you know that this week's news is brought to you by Thomas Francis University. Thomas Francis University is a metaphysics school that offers online spiritually based bachelor's, master's, and PhD doctoral metaphysical degrees, as well as single standalone courses in related metaphysical and esoteric topics. Instructors are easily accessible and offer world-class customer service and instruction. TFU and other ICMH schools have hundreds of students and graduates in more than 50 countries worldwide. For more information on Thomas Francis University, please visit tfuniversity.org. And... yeah, it's hard to believe. It's the first day of spring. And people get a little nutty about this time of the year. I don't know why. It's just a lot of weird stuff. People get into astrology and start talking about Mercury. And I don't know what's going on up there. There's nothing magical here. It's just science, really. It's the first day of spring in the Northern Hemisphere. And... let's see. There's winter weather headed to the northeast. Well, what else is new? But it occurs twice a year. We have one in the fall. We have one in the spring. So we should be used to this stuff. And equinox in Latin translates to equal night. So in other words, both day and night are equal of equal time, which is weird because here in the Northern Hemisphere, we're like, well, it should be a lot warmer than it is if day and night are equal, but it'll get better. It'll get better. And the days will now become longer at the higher latitudes because it takes the sun longer to rise and set. All these are tweets and stuff that I'm reading. NOAA, the National Oceanographic Atmospheric, whoever they are, you know who NOAA is. I'm just scrolling here. So I was on lunch, I guess, when this happened. I didn't realize this. The sun was directly overhead at approximately 12:15 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Tuesday, according to time and date. So that's when it happened. That's when everything was perfectly balanced. You guys should know that it doesn't fall on the same day every year. Sometimes it's on the 21st, and it's also as early as March 19th, depending upon the year. And, well, let's just talk. I just mentioned this. The whole, you know, I mentioned balanced. I'm balancing it. I'm making fun of the egg balancing. Is that true? A lot of people wonder about the whole egg balancing thing, and people actually make a big deal out of this, I guess. I didn't realize. I made fun of some people for this, and they were mad because they didn't realize the reality behind all this. Yes, you can balance an egg today. There's no problem. But in reality, you could do it every day, not just today. This is an ancient myth that claims that an egg can balance on its end only during a vernal equinox. And every year, people gather to attempt this challenge. Now, AccuWeather states that this myth was popularized in the United States following a Life article in 1945, which explains the old spring adage. But it's false. Trust me, I've tried it. The vernal equinox brings no special egg balancing properties with it. Sending an egg on its end is something just about anyone can do any day of the year. The feat simply takes the right egg and a little trial and practice. Yes, and egg against the wall, like I did the first time I tried this. But probably the coolest thing that happens today that I didn't believe in, but I've been to the area. I haven't been to this particular location, but around this spot is people go down to a place called Chichen Itza. And Chichen Itza is an old Mayan, basically a city, a huge complex. It's probably one of the most popular ones to go to. It's in the northern part of the area down there, the Mexican Riviera. The Yucatan Peninsula, whatever you want to call it in that area. But I've been to a few further south of that area, and this is the one to go to. It's the biggest one, Chichen Itza. It's the probably the most traveled to Mayan destination anywhere in Mexico. Heavily traveled. It's the largest one. But they have this weird thing that happens during the equinox, and actually in the fall and in the spring, twice a year, again, spring and fall, there's a shadow that falls on the pyramid in the shape of a serpent. It looks like it's coming down the stairs, and there's a head at the bottom, at the base of the staircase, and the shadow joins up with it. It's pretty cool. Chichen Itza, and you can look up the serpent, or just look up Equinox Serpent, and you should see plenty of pictures about that. I wasn't prepared for that for the chat room. I could probably look that up real quick for you guys, but it's pretty cool, and there's videos out there that show it, and I don't know, it's pretty neat. It just, you know, Mayans made this stuff up, and I don't know, it's pretty neat. But yeah, the egg thing, don't worry about it. You can do it any time of the year. It's nothing special for this particular holiday. So getting into the news, like I mentioned, we have quite a bit of Bigfoot stuff in the news this week. And let's see. Well, we'll go to North Carolina for the first story. How's that? Fox Carolina featured a story with a headline that said a New York group claims that they have evidence that Bigfoot exists. No way. Really? Bigfoot exists, and they have the proof. There it is. They must have it. So I guess the rest of us don't even need to bother looking anymore, right? Because they've got it. Well, in the article, I'm always such a smarty pants. In the article posted last Friday, there's a little bit of mention of the group North Carolina Bigfoot, which I guess is the group. I think it's only led by one guy, but that's cool. It could be a group with one person, I suppose, that has posted photos periodically that show footprints and bent branches that they feel provide evidence of Bigfoot. But the majority of the story actually focuses on Jim Charnesky, who is the leader of North Carolina Bigfoot, who also teaches a course on North Carolina Bigfoot at Maryland Community College, which, no, it's not in Maryland. It's located in Spruce Pine, North Carolina. Charnesky mentions that he hopes to he can teach this course in the Asheville, North Carolina area as well, and states to those who might not believe, quote, "Keep an open mind. There are more sightings in our area than what most people are aware of. I don't think they're all misidentifications," unquote. Well, I think most of them are, Jim, but I'm glad you're trying to get out there and you're educating people about the topic instead of, you know, just posting a bunch of pictures of muddy footprints and depressions that maybe are not even footprints and a bunch of broken branches and different things on a Facebook page, because that seems like the extent of a lot of people. Their work, that I should say, of a lot of people out there, unfortunately. So at least he's teaching. He's trying to expand other people's knowledge, I suppose. That's probably the good way to put it. And the course description from the Maryland Community College website says it's a three-hour course, like a three-hour tour, and it costs only $25. It's not too bad, really, for a college course. Not like you're going to pay tuition for that class. And the description of the class states, quote, "This class will review local history and sightings of North Carolina Bigfoot. Topics covered include how to collect evidence, tools and equipment of modern research, sounds, signs, and behavioral traits. And participants will also be invited and encouraged to relate their own experiences." Instructor Jim Charnesky is a field researcher for the Bigfoot Field Researchers Organization, BFRO, which conducts the show Finding Bigfoot on the Animal Planet. And that's it. That's the description. That's pretty cool. Well, you might be a big BFRO member, but I know a lot of BFRO members. And obviously, Matt, Mr. Moneymaker, to those that don't know him, obviously he runs the show. He's the big, the face of the organization. He's really the mainstay on that television show. It's not as if a lot of different people get to show up on the show. So, yeah, I get it. I don't know if, I guess it's okay to use the claim to fame of the television show as part of your course description. But it's good. I'm glad to see some of this stuff is in here. I mean, obviously, I don't know to what detail or what extent a lot of this stuff is being taught, but it's good anyway to talk about some of the modern research, how to collect evidence. I think these are some important topics, but again, I don't know how deep and rich that kind of stuff is going to be. But $25 for 3 hours, I mean, you could do worse. You can go watch some of these movies that come out. So if you're in the, if you're in the North Carolina area, you're into Bigfoot, seems to be a pretty popular place in the last few months. I might want to check that out. So it sounds pretty cool. And now we'll go, getting out ahead of myself. We'll get some of these links thrown into the chat room. And if you're listening live and you're not in the chat room, you're missing out, because I throw all these links into the chat room, and then during the week, if I'm not sick, I think I forgot last week because I was a little under the weather, as they say. I think I forgot to throw some of these links up. I was throwing other things up, I think. And yeah, you can have quick access to these links. Otherwise, yeah, you're going to have to wait until I post them on Facebook, which is connected to Twitter. And you can get all of the links through the socials, as they say. Is that what the young people say? I don't know. I'm not that young. People think I'm like 30-something. That's awesome. I wish. Yeah, socials, social media outlets, Facebook, YouTube. You can find me there, Paranews Insider, or at Paranews Insider, Facebook and Twitter, respectively. Yeah, but the best way, I mean, just tune in live. You get this stuff. There's a whole bunch of people in the chat room. You can chit-chat. You can make fun of me. Whatever you want to do, it's fine. Live every night at 8 o'clock Eastern. Well, now we're going to go a little further out west. And we're going to start off in, well, we'll start off in Nebraska and work our way even further west. In other biggest Bigfoot finding of the century news, which we seem to have every week, seems like somebody is trying to one-up everybody else. Well, I have the best find. I have the best information, whatever, whatever. Now we're talking about mattresses. This is a first for me. I don't think I've ever talked about footprints on a mattresses, at least on the air on a paranormal radio show. A mattress has been recovered that supposedly, purportedly, maybe has Bigfoot prints on it. Well, that's the claim made by, well, here we go, Finding Bigfoot television show, one of the hosts, Cliff Brockman. Now, Cliff was attending the Nebraska Bigfoot Conference in mid-February when he received an email discussing the prints on said mattress. Being from Oregon, he quickly emailed some friends to go and retrieve as much evidence as possible until he could get to the location. Now, the location of the mattress was actually, it wasn't deep in the woods. It was actually on the side of a road. So I don't know how, you know, they're talking about remoteness and how nobody should be barefoot in the woods or Bigfoot barefoot in the woods. I don't know how that goes. But if it's on the side of the road, I don't know. To me, that kind of questions things a little bit, raises a little bit of a red flag. But before I discount the whole thing, let me get through this here. Now, this particular researcher actually has passed by the old abandoned futon mattress a couple of times, but didn't realize it was the one that was named by the witness for another day after that. So it sat out in the weather, which wasn't good. And it was actually kind of sort of good because they noticed that the initial witnesses' pictures and what they discovered when they finally got to the mattress and cut out the piece where the footprints were, there was a deterioration already of the mud, of the footprints. So they knew it had to be pretty recent, just prior to this person seeing it. But with the pieces of the mattress, the top layer were cut out, and it was still left by the side of the road. It's kind of weird because they complained about it, but they still left it there. I don't know. I'm just reading what I read here. Cliff was able to investigate the site days later due to weather and travel and a lot of other things, but nothing solid was found. They did see some partial prints in and around the mattress, but really nothing conclusive. Despite the rainy weather in probably before, during, and more than likely a little after that as well, around that area. You know, rain can be a good friend, but it can also be an evil foe when it comes to collecting and finding footprints of any sort of animal. Yes, animals will step in mud and create very beautiful, very realistic, and very friendly tracks, especially when they dry, but continued rain, continued precipitation, and varying temperatures will erode and destroy any kind of beautiful track fairly quickly. So, yeah, the weather can work for you, and it can work against you very, very quickly. And I'd say they're very, very lucky to get what they got in that amount of time that they were able to collect this evidence. The only stuff they came away with, I guess, was on the mattress. And there was actually, they could tell that there was still an impression in the mattress from this foot, which is pretty significant because it takes a lot of weight. I mean, yeah, these mattresses, these futon mattresses, you know, they're not the best. It's not like one of those number comfort beds, whatever the heck they're called. But, you know, there's still a little bit of, you know, they're a little pliable. So crush them, they come back. But something heavy, that heavy to crush it. But hopefully they can figure out the manufacturer and they can maybe do some tests to utilize this futon mattress. I think it should be possible that they should be able to, and that's why I would have collected the whole thing. Maybe you could do compression tests on it to determine what would kind of weight would take to make this a kind of impression and get a little bit better of a guide or a kind of a you know, was it 150 pounds? Did it take 500 pounds? Where exactly, where in this range would this have occurred? I don't know. That's just me thinking. I think I would have collected the whole entire thing and not just cut out little bits and pieces. I mean, obviously it was abandoned on the side of the road. I think, if you find garbage, I'm pretty sure, I don't know what the state laws in Oregon are about finding garbage on the side of the road, but pretty much anywhere else, I think it's free game. And I do think it was in State Park, Alderwood State Park, Wayside Park in Oregon. So I don't know. Maybe that was a kind of a gray area where you're afraid to take something, but you did cut it up. So I don't know. Just thinking out loud here. Now, Paul Seaburn, he's a writer for Mysterious Universe, one of the probably one of the top, I'll give it that, top three or four paranormal news websites that are out there. Now, he jokingly says that this find in the Alderwood State Wayside Park in Oregon could go on to become what may be known as the Shroud of Alderwood in the future of Bigfootology. Yeah. You notice I've used the word Bigfootology a couple of times. I'm doing it on purpose. I'll tell you why. I'm doing it because I'd like to see, and I know some people are going to get mad, but you know what? I don't care. You know, cryptozoology has its problems. It has its issues. But a lot of this Bigfoot stuff that I'm talking about is making cryptozoology look really silly. So my goal, my hope is that we can look at Bigfoot. Obviously, Bigfoot is a cryptid. It belongs in cryptozoology. But to look at Bigfoot as maybe almost its own kind of category within cryptozoology, or maybe even outside of cryptozoology. It's a debatable topic on both ends, obviously, for anything, whether it's, is this a real living creature, Gigantopithecus, or is this a interdimensional alien extraterrestrial biological entity creeping around, or is it just some sort of creature from other dimensions? That's why I think Bigfoot deserves its own field of study. And you see a lot of these cryptid events, paranormal conferences, you know, ghost stuff, but you also see a lot of cryptid stuff. A majority of these cryptid events are just geared towards Bigfoot. That's pretty much it. You know, you may have one speaker or another cover some sort of topic, you know, black cats or something else like that. But for the most part, most of these cryptid events are all about Bigfoot. So why isn't Bigfoot viewed as Bigfootology? Why isn't it its own little subcategory of cryptozoology? I'm not saying to eliminate it from cryptozoology, but certainly kind of pushing that stinky, strange cousin off to the side of the room might be in order. Yeah, I just called it a stinky, creepy cousin. But yeah, I don't know. Let me post that link there in the chat room. Bigfoot. Well, there's more Bigfoot stuff here. So strap on your wooden shoes. Yeah, in more Israel, I'll show you why I know so. News tonight, the California lawsuit. You remember this? How could you forget, right? Now, this is brought forth by Bigfoot researcher Claudia Ackley. You know, the news is making her out to be some just random hiker with teenage daughters. Oh my gosh, and this big flying tree was threatening them. No, she's a Bigfoot researcher. She knows what she's doing. And again, I'll say, I think it's embarrassing, but when teenage daughter, was she even a teen? I think she was preteen, wasn't she? That she collected the best evidence of the family. Ouch. Anyway, the lawsuit in California brought forth by Bigfoot researcher Claudia Ackley, well, it's been dismissed. No big surprise, but the surprise actually is that Claudia herself actually petitioned the court to drop the lawsuit so that it could be rewritten. So it'll be back, be put back in place in the near future, and we'll see what happens with that. It was advised her that if she did go forward with the lawsuit as it was, she would be, quote, eaten alive. I think I've actually said the same thing, that they would get eaten alive in court. So yeah, eaten alive is why they took it out of court. Now, Ackley has teamed up with Todd Standing, and Todd Standing is the creator of the documentary. And I say that very, it sounded like really angry that I said that. I don't know. I have other words I'd like to use, but this is family radio. The documentary Discovering Bigfoot that appeared earlier this year on Netflix, I finally got through it all. I finally made it through it. I don't know how I did. It's really, I don't know. Not that convincing. I'll just say that. Not that convincing. I'll be politically correct. Standing commented on the situation by saying, quote, "There's so many things a lawyer has to do appropriately. We now have a team of lawyers in the U.S. who are going to put it together. They have to interview all the witnesses. They have a lot of work to do. The legal action is going to be enormous now." Unquote. Enormous. Okay. We'll see how enormous it's going to be. Now, Daniel Perez, a Riverside-based Bigfoot researcher and historian in California who publishes the monthly Bigfoot Times newsletter, well, he, like a lot of people in the Bigfootology field, are not convinced. He says, quote, "I suspect it will be dismissed for a lack of evidence. I can't see the matter getting any legal footing." And he also said, "I did talk with some people at the Bigfoot Bonanza just recently who live near Claudia, and they know the area well, and they reported that outside of Claudia and her claims, no one else is reporting anything Bigfoot in the area. This whole matter is bad publicity for the serious Bigfoot community, and just one more reason why a great many folks across the nation take the matter with a grain of salt." Unquote. Throw down the mic, I guess. My goodness. Bigfoot Bonanza, by the way, I didn't have a link to it. My events, I don't know. I was really slacking, I guess. Well, it was a Bigfoot-related event that took place earlier this month in the San Francisco area. I think it was actually in San Francisco, California. Now, I don't think this is jealousy. I think a lot of people would say, well, it sounds like he's just jealous because she's getting all the attention and he's just not getting any, anything from this or whatever. And okay, you can say that. I mean, he's a speaker. He spoke at the Bigfoot Bonanza along with Lauren Coleman, some other names out there in cryptozoology. Yeah, I don't think this is jealousy coming for Perez. I mean, quite a few people I've seen mention this or I've personally talked to about the matter. They pretty much agree. This is really not the right way. And you've heard me say this. I don't think this is the right way to go. Nor is the evidence, I think, in their corner convincing enough to sway non-believers or even those on the fence about this topic. I mean, yeah, I mean, you have Dr. Jeff Meldrum, you have all this, you have the Finding Bigfoot Bigfoot TV, Discovering Bigfoot show and all that stuff. But I don't know. You have to understand this evidence has to stand up in a court of law, literally. Stand up in a court of law. I mean, you have to prove beyond the shadow of a doubt. And I just don't think that no matter what evidence is provided, I don't think it's going to be enough, no matter what you do. I really don't. I think there's other ways to go about this. Unfortunately, we just have to bide our time and collect data, continue to collect information, continue to collect firsthand witness reports, and hopefully one day a body will present itself. Unfortunately, that's what it's going to take. I mean, I know people don't want to hear that, and I'm not advocating going out and shooting Bigfoot. Absolutely not. I think that's the wrong thing to do. I'm not in favor of that whatsoever. But at the same time, again, I'm not justifying shooting or killing one. Hopefully we can find one or pieces thereof and not on some crazy guy on YouTube who claims to have it. Hopefully we'll find parts that we can evaluate scientifically by a third party instead of people within the Bigfoot field themselves coming up with this stuff and coming up with their own data or information. And with that, let me throw this last link there in the chat room. Hopefully I don't hit anybody this time. Oh my gosh, almost got Paul. That's all right, he's tough. He can handle it. And just want to remind you that you're listening to WCJV Digital Broadcasting from Youngstown, New York, emanating live at WCJVradio.com. And you're listening to the Paranormal News Insider with your host, Dr. Brian D. Parsons, here at the bottom of the hour, and we're still talking about cryptozoology. But the good news is we're done with Bigfootology. This next story, this is the big story, probably the biggest story, not only in cryptozoology, but also in the paranormal. I'm going that far. And this surrounds, yes, that photograph taken on the beach of St. Simon's Island in southern Georgia. And I'm fairly certain you've probably more than likely have seen this photograph by now. It's gained a lot of traction in the media. When this first broke a couple of days ago, I think it was, 4 days ago, it got a little bit of attention. And it's just kind of spiraled into pretty much nationwide, a worldwide story, actually. So it's being talked about everywhere right now. And who knows how long this is going to survive in the news, but you're going to get some good information tonight because it's actually the story has been updated within the last few hours. So you're going to get the latest information live tonight. Now, a lot of people, when they first saw this photograph, they were very, very quick to jump on the plesiosaur bandwagon. Plesiosaur. Tomato, tomato, whatever you, however you want to call it. Somebody corrected me one time when I said plesiosaur. They said it's a plesiosaur. I don't know. I wasn't around. I'm not that old. I don't know what they're called. That's what I know how to say it. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. I don't care. Yeah, a lot of people jumped on that bandwagon and said plesiosaur. That's got to be it. But then again, a lot of other people used that same knee-jerk reaction and said, no, it's Photoshop. It's fake. Just fake. That's what a lot of people said. Well, you know what? Honestly, neither one of those judgments is really worthwhile for anything. It doesn't really accomplish anything. Whether you're completely believing this or you're completely dismissing it, neither one of these stances really does any good. Can't rush the judgment. We have to look at the facts. What are the facts of the story? What are the facts of the photograph? What do we see here? What can we identify? And what information can be useful towards identifying this or identifying the possibilities of the legitimacy of this story? Now, the story started off at news4jax.com, and that's Jacksonville, Florida. And it reads, quote, Jeff Warren and his son were at Wolf Island National Refuge. Wolf Island National Wildlife Refuge. It's a lot to chew on and digest. This is just north of St. Simon's Island in Georgia. Friday, when they came upon the creature on a barrier island. That's important there, a barrier island. Warren thought it was a dead seal, but said when he got a closer look at it, it resembled more of the Loch Ness Monster. Warren sent the photo to News4Jax and said the creature was about 4 to 5 feet long with two fins, although only one can be seen in the picture. The creature has little teeth, about 1/8 of an inch long. And is this creature a sea monster or just an oddly shaped fish? For now, it remains a mystery, unquote. Well, that was exciting when the story broke out, and there was a lot of, I don't think people really read all this stuff, because people were saying, we can't find the beach. We don't know where this is. Nobody could find it. People are out looking for it. It's a barrier island. It's a barrier island. It's not right on the shoreline. Anyway, some of the questions here, there's no scale on this thing. And that's what drives me nuts when I see a picture of something and somebody says, well, it was 4 to 5 feet long. Where's the scale? There's nothing lying next to this thing. There's not even a foot or anything for us to look at to judge the size of this thing. It could be, for all we know, it could be the size of a little kid's toy. It could be the size of a little army man taken with a nice camera. It could be 30 feet long for all we know. We don't know. There's no scale. Use scale when you're taking a picture of something like this. Well, I mean, I did some research. I'm not, obviously, you know, I look at these photos. I try to find matching photos or pieces and parts of these photos to see whether or not there's anything I can figure out. And again, with no scale, it's hard to determine, is this a model, a mock-up, or even a Photoshop of some sort of water monster cryptid, or water like a dead shark or an actual animal. It's just distorted or Photoshopped. You know, we don't know. It's so hard to determine that. But I could not find any kind of matching photograph. But I was well aware. I knew there was a local monster. There's a local cryptid. Altamaha-ha is kind of the name of this thing. The Altamaha River was said to have a creature that lived in the near shore channels. And it looked an awful lot like the Loch Ness Monster. And, you know, I wondered if somebody was just trying to make this kind of story pop up. I haven't heard anything recently about this. I know there's a lot of stories. There's a lot of local websites from the Jacksonville area, even into southern Georgia area, that do talk about this. Altamaha, or Alti is the other name that they use for it. And I haven't heard anything new, so I wondered if maybe they were just using this photograph as a way to regain a little bit of exposure for this local cryptid. And it was weird, because I just was re-researching this creature, just kind of getting an understanding, even though I wasn't thinking that this photograph actually was this Alti creature, but I just wanted to familiarize myself with this local urban legend or local folklore about this local a cryptid, water-based cryptid. But a couple of days later, March 18th, the story was updated from March 16th. And you always pay attention to that, too. That's one thing very critical. When you're reading a news story, always look at what time it was published and then look to see when it's updated. So you can follow a story with one link. And if the people are actually doing their job correctly, they will update that individual story when new information provides itself. So this link was updated on March 18th, saying that the story could be solved. So it got my attention, obviously. But local author Taylor Brown had contacted News4Jax to tell them that the photograph looked exactly like the Altamaha-ha, or Alti for short. And it can actually be seen as a model mock-up in a visitor's center in Darien, Georgia, located along the interstate. You know, those little rest stop things. It's got the pamphlets. You go water skiing here, go to these wineries there. Oh, they got a little cryptid in there. I don't think I've ever seen that. Just stop in there. Anyway, located along the interstate, there's even a billboard showing the creature and urging travelers to stop and take a photo, but don't get too close. I mean, heck, the Altamaha-ha even has a Wikipedia entry. Before I get too close, I actually have some pictures. Yeah. Where'd it go? Okay, there it is. Some picture that I'll share here in the chat room. It's got kind of a composite of some stuff I just talked about. At the top there, you'll see the sea creature billboard sign. You can see a sea creature, kind of weird. And then at the bottom there, you see the actual plastic model. It's pretty big. Actually, I guess it's life size. It's probably about, 15 feet long, maybe. And there in the middle, you see the actual photograph that was taken just a few days ago of this purported creature. They kind of look pretty similar, don't they? Pretty interesting. Uh-oh. The plot thickens. Now, again, I have heard of Alti, but again, began to research the creature out of sheer curiosity. And once I saw this on the 18th break that, this local author had made the connection himself, I really wanted to kind of look around to see if any stories had popped up recently or if anybody local was really heavily involved with Alti to maybe kind of do a little digging to maybe see if maybe somebody was behind some sort of hoax. Now, it seems one of the biggest stories surrounding this creature is out of 1981, where a pair of witnesses, Larry Gwynn and Steve Wilson, saw the creature at the same time, and their story went national. Now, this is according to quite a few websites, including two local ones that I was able to find. They made the same claim. Well, I looked it up, Larry Gwynn and Steve Wilson, and their national story in 1981. Well, the story was actually published in the Weekly World News. Now, if you know anything about the Weekly World News, it's not the most accurate information. We were talking about the Bat Boy, all these weird made-up fake stories falsified and sometimes just using misinformation. We even had Bessie the Lake Erie Monster was in there in the 90s. That supposedly capsized boats, and people actually put that on Wikipedia that it was true. It's not true. Weekly World News, that made up all sorts of stories, embellished just as many. It's no longer found on newsstands, so don't bother looking. You can look it up online. I think it's still alive online, maybe. I mean, but what about all the other stories? There's got to be some truth to this creature, right? Well, again, let's examine the claims. The claim is that this is a long-lost plesiosaur, which is possible, right? Because the coelacanth survived detection for over 65 million years, right? I've seen this probably about 10 times in comments on different stories. People make that connection. Well, the coelacanth did it, so why can't a plesiosaur? All I got to say about that is nope. Nope. The coelacanth was known to locals. And it had actually been fished for decades. Decades. Fishermen knew about it. People knew about these fish. But science didn't. Scientists discovered and revered them for being a link to ancient fish thought to be extinct. And that was the greatest, supposedly it's quoted as being the greatest animal discovery of the 20th century. But the plesiosaur is an order of marine reptiles, not a dinosaur, that existed over 200 million years ago and became extinct around 66 million years ago and were commonly thought to be cold-blooded. So this means that that Loch Ness and even the ocean near Georgia, that water would be far too cold for a creature like this to survive, especially for generations. Probably could survive in tropical waters, but you look at animals like the manatee, they have a hard time surviving in less than tropical water, I guess you could say. And they frequently die when the water gets anywhere near 60 degrees. So a plesiosaur probably not going to be able to survive even in the inland waters, between the ocean and the fresh water. That would be a little bit warmer, yes. I agree, but still probably not going to survive if they're cold blood. Now, there is some new evidence that suggests that maybe some of these animals were warm-blooded. That's still not going to help it out. These were reptiles. Actually, plesiosaurs were animals that were thought to have gone back into the ocean from land, and these would have been air-breathing creatures. Not their air-breathing creatures. They have to come to the surface to take a breath of air. This would highly increase their chances of being seen. Now, lastly, Alti has two front flippers in the photograph. A plesiosaur had four flippers. And I don't think of any animal, a creature, ancient creature from anywhere from 50, 60 million years ago, all the way to 250 million years ago, only had the two flippers like that. Now, could this creature be a product of evolution? Maybe they got rid of the back flippers. They wanted to be cool like dolphins. I don't know. Not very likely. Again, no signs that a two-flippered creature like this ever existed in the plesiosaurs. And plesiosaurs, like dinosaurs, they grew very large only to die out during the KT extinction 66 million years ago. And like a majority of the creatures of that time, plesiosaurs, they have no living relatives. So that really puts a damper. No segment of this lived beyond 65, 66, well, I should say recent, as recently as 65 million years ago. 66, that was it. They punched out. They were gone. So what's in this photograph? Odd hide that this is probably was a legitimate creature. And a lot of people, including myself, when I first saw it, I was thinking shark. Got to be honest. Or fake. Got to be honest. But again, you have to let the evidence speak. You don't speak for the evidence. Thinking it was probably an underdeveloped basking shark based on the tail and the basic body structure. And basking shark is always mentioned in these cases. But it seems to me that I think this has been altered a little bit. Digital manipulation with some software. It just doesn't seem normal or natural to me. And again, I couldn't find any kind of source photograph for the creature, whatever's in the photo. But who's to say until someone steps forward or we find the body? The body is still out there. No one's found this thing. No one said, hey, here it is. Or I cut a chunk of it off and put it in my pocket. Nothing. Now, marine biologists at Jacksonville University state that the photograph is a hoax. And the Georgia Department of Natural Resources states that no one has come forward with information about a carcass or even a location for the carcass. And just today, just a few hours ago, Newsweek released another headline on this story that said, quote, scientists say mysterious Georgia creature is likely just a rotting fish or shark, unquote. Megan McCormick, a PhD student in aquatic resources at Texas State University, told Newsweek, quote, I would say pretty certainly that it's not a never-before-seen sea monster and would lean towards some kind of fish. A basking shark sounds probable, unquote. So I hate to slam the book on this one. I hate to shut the door and say it's over. It's done. You can't just make a judgment here. There's not enough information really to go any direction. Honestly, I have to say that. Now, a basking shark is essentially, you could say it's the water cryptid equivalent to explaining away UFOs with swamp gas or weather balloons. It's the knee-jerk reaction. But a lot of times, quite a few cases, yes, have been explained by this. Even though basking sharks really aren't seen that much. But they do seem to pop up as the logical explanation, a proven logical explanation. And a lot of these cases of these misidentified creatures that aren't, these aquatic creatures that aren't really globsters. And by globsters, I mean just like this massive mess of flesh laying on the beach that is really highly unidentified. But again, just like Bigfoot, until we get a body, this explanation is useless, in my opinion. Give me a body. Give us some tissue samples or get us other angles. Supposedly, there's video of this, so there's other angles. And I'd really love to see that. Because right now, I'm not buying it. I'm not buying it at all. So real cool. Real quick here, quick like. I'm going to do the book of the week here. And it's, I've talked about in the past about going in different directions with some of these books of the week and talking about science or talking about different topics and subjects. I think this week, quite a good opportunity. I picked up a book a few months ago at a bookstore, and it's on a topic that I think a lot of people enjoy. It's very loosely based with the paranormal, but as we've just discussed, there is a link, there is a connection, and that is with dinosaurs. Yeah, I might be an old fart, but I still like dinosaurs. And for me, I have a whole collection of dinosaur books, but these go back to late 80s, early and mid 90s, pretty much is the time frame for a majority of my books. And as you well know, a lot has changed as far as dinosaurs. So I bought kind of an up-to-date or a more up-to-date version. I'm not a big believer, a big fan of thinking of dinosaurs with feathers, but I've kind of gotten over that a little bit. But to kind of keep up to date with new findings, it is necessary, if you're into dinosaurs or ancient creatures, prehistoric life, to kind of update your books every now and again and get some of this new information. So the book of the week this week is it's more of a kid's book, if anything, but I found it fascinating. A lot of pictures, a lot of great information. It's called The Encyclopedia of Dinosaurs and Prehistoric Life. I know it's kind of a kid's book, but hey, we're all kids at heart, right? I hope. And it's a pretty cool book, and it's not just dinosaurs. It's again, prehistoric life. And yes, it does talk about plesiosaurs, also pterodactyls and all those fun things, but also dinosaurs, also plant life. So if you're into dinosaurs at all or ancient creatures, and maybe you're a fan of the new wave of Jurassic Park movies, who isn't? I mean, I read the Michael Crichton book before the movie even came out. I'm a huge fan of that series. I could go on and on about how things I like or dislike about it, but about the new stuff. But it is a huge thing. And dinosaurs, they'll never go away. They'll never be out of fashion. I think kids will always love it. They'll always make a little dinosaur, little shirts for little boys. It's always going to be something that people find fascinating. And this book, I was surprised because I was thinking kids' book. It's got a big picture of a dinosaur in the front. But I'm telling you, there's a lot of information in this book that goes well beyond what I had expected. And definitely, I don't know, I guess I could say tickled my fancy as far as the dinosauria world is concerned. So that's the book of the week this week. The Encyclopedia of Dinosaurs and Prehistoric Life by Miles Kelly. There's multiple editions of this book. Mine is up to date. It's from last year, 2017. And like I said, it's huge. This book is huge. It's heavy. 460. Well, you get the gist. It's big. You can easily keep a door ajar for quite a while with it. But anyway, a couple more stories real quick. Very sad news. I was, like I said, I was recovering last week. I was really sick and really not following. I'm the kind of person, I don't know, eventually it's going to catch up to me. When I get sick, I just bury myself in my room, pull the sheets over my head, and when I'm ready, I come out. I'm alive, hopefully. I just kind of try to sleep it off and just stay away from society. And it wasn't really keeping up the tabs on anything. But I saw that Professor Stephen Hawking had passed away, and I honestly got upset. I mean, I know a lot of people get upset when these rock stars all die, but, you know, rock and roll, come on. You got to expect that. But Professor Stephen Hawking passed away last week. One of the probably the most well-known theoretical physicist of his time. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of other guys that are kind of getting a little bit of press lately, but over the course of the last 40, 50 years, he was the guy. And probably one of the leading minds on the planet, despite what you might think about his severe physical disabilities. Hawking outlived his diagnosis of ALS at age 21, where he was given 2 years to live by doctors. And certainly at most, he would only live 5 years. So he wasn't really looking to make even age 25. But he lived until age 76. And it's monumental for someone with ALS. And he's a hero to those who suffer this disease and has been really somebody everyone's looked up to for that. And especially as a scientist, you look up to him for that as well. Multiple generations of scientists have followed his work and looked up to him. And he's inspired a lot of people in many, many ways. And what's weird about this, I know I can make something weird about somebody who passed away, but he was born 300 years after the death of Galileo. That's not a huge secret. But what's weird is he passed away 139 years to the day of Einstein's birth. Weird stuff. Hawking has been mentioned during this show a number of times over the last few years, and most recently, and typically, it's been over his fear-mongering, you know, his telling us, yeah, you better be careful about contacting intelligent life forms. But the science world will sorely miss him, and it's sad because people are talking about his latest work, some of his latest findings and things he was working about, the universe, the origins of the universe, and everyone's thinking, oh my gosh, this could be the big thing. Well, you know, go back and read all the stuff that he's written. I mean, this guy is, every time he puts anything out there, he's changing the way we think about the world around us. And maybe it's good that he's finally getting some people's attention that really wouldn't have paid him any attention. Last but not least, we talk about YouTube. Why on earth would I want to talk about YouTube? Well, one of the big things that you see a lot of, and I make mention of this every now and again, is conspiracy theorists and YouTube. Well, YouTube is swinging back at some of these conspiracy theorists. And, you know, these conspiracy theorists, websites and channels, I guess, YouTube channels have become very, very popular. You know a few of them. I know you do. I'm not going to name them because you. Now, YouTube CEO Susan Wojcicki made an announcement at the South by Southwest conference in Austin, Texas. I usually go there for the music. Now, this comes after the mass shooting in Parkland, Florida, where a conspiracy theory video suggested that one of the survivors was a crisis actor. I don't know how I feel about that. I think that's just kind of. Anyway, the video was trending and garnered over 200,000 videos or views before it was finally taken down. It was actually trending very high as one of the most watched videos. Now, YouTube supports freedom of speech and expression. She started out her interview on South by Southwest by stating that. But it seems to be drawing a little bit of a line in the sand here when it comes to some of these topics. And personally, I know people might not want to hear this, but I think it's long overdue. I mean, I'm all about freedom of speech and freedom of expression. Trust me. But when you're making stuff up just because you want to make a little bit of money, I think that's where the issue is. And it's not just that, but into it, and they actually believe it. And you basically create a cult following. That's very dangerous. Now, videos marked as conspiracy theory-based content will now have what is being called information cues. And these information cues will link to content such as Wikipedia that will provide verified information on the topic. Wojcicki said during her interview, quote, "Our goal is to start with a list of internet conspiracies listed on the internet where there is a lot of active discussion on YouTube," unquote. Now, if that wasn't controversy enough and confusion about this new move, Wikimedia, the parent of Wikipedia, put out a statement that it had no prior knowledge of YouTube putting these links into their content. YouTube did not want to use internal links to other videos in order to avoid perceived favoritism or other issues. But using Wikipedia seems to potentially create other issues. Wikipedia is edited by contributors and volunteers, and if these conspiracy theory websites feel threatened, they may find the means to rewrite these Wikipedia pages and fight with those who attempt to continuously correct information, thus attempting to harm the already shaky culture of Wikipedia entries. A lot of people don't trust it, but trust me, I'm a Wikipedia editor, and sometimes even I get things wrong, and stuff when I get things wrong gets corrected very quickly. So trust me, they're watching. Now, YouTube should probably take a look at itself internally as to why they've allowed this culture of conspiracy theory sites to flourish, which at the heart of many of these videos break every type of community guidelines they had written for YouTube. Now, one suggests that maybe they start by changing their recommended and trending algorithms, or at least having a bit more eyes actually physically watching the channel instead of allowing computers to do all the work. And this story is just really breaking over the last couple of days, and this is bound to be a very, very, very hot topic in the very near future, especially here in the paranormal, where there's a lot of UFO disinformation websites and conspiracy theory websites tied into a variety of culture that we do talk about here on the Paranormal News Insider. So kind of keep an eye on this story, and I don't think you're going to have to search too hard for it, because I think it's going to be jumping off the internet, off of social media, and you're going to be hearing an awful lot about this. But before you jump into any kind of a corner about this and try to fight back against it, just really try to read about it and understand the issues and understand all the angles before we just try to say that they're just trying to shut down freedom of speech. Because if you just watch the video, and you'll see that they're very adamant about this, and other companies and corporations really feel that YouTube is not cracking down enough. So again, we'll have to keep an eye on this in the near future to see how things are going to play out with YouTube and how people are going to react to that. And I'll throw that last link there in the chat room. And that is it, kids. We're done. We're out of here. And I'll see you next week. But for now, keep your eyes in the skies, your ears in the woods, the hair standing on the back of your neck, and always keep your mind slightly ajar. And above all else, don't stop believing. For the Paranormal News Insider, this is Dr. Persons reporting.